Stories of Journey to the West, Chapter 97.
On a dark, rainy night, we're in a place called Tom Taifu. The Tang monk and his disciples, they found shelter in this sort of broken-down house, probably grateful just to be out of the weather, right?
Absolutely. But while they're sheltering, there's a very different kind of storm brewing nearby, isn't there?
There certainly is. So in Dailing County, which is part of Tong Taifu, there's this group, about over 30 desperate individuals.
Yeah. The source tells us they've just utterly squandered their family fortunes, you know, on vices like prostitution, drinking, gambling.
The usual suspects.
Pretty much. They're completely destitute and clearly out of options.
So their motive is just pure desperation then, driving them to crime just to keep going.
Exactly. Yeah. To sustain that unsustainable lifestyle.
Yeah.
And who becomes their target in this desperate situation?
Who indeed?
Well, they specifically identify Ko Yuanwei, also known as Ku Hong, as being incredibly wealthy.
Okay, Ko Yuanwei, that's like the patriarch, the elder of the Ku family. A man of some standing.
Precisely. A man of significant standing. And he's also the very person who had just hosted the Tang Dynasty monks in a grand feast.
Ah, okay.
Which is a detail that becomes, well, ironically significant later on.
I see. And they're not just hoping for a quick smash and grab, are they? The source sounds like they had a pretty well thought out plan.
Oh, yeah. No, this is strategic. They plan to strike exactly on this rainy night.
Using the weather.
Right. Leveraging the bad weather when streets are empty, official patrols are maybe a bit lax.
Smart in a dark way.
And they come prepared. They've got a full arsenal. Short knives, caltrops, grappling hooks, mace, rope, and torches. It really suggests a level of organization, you know, an intent beyond just simple opportunism.
Okay, so the scene unfolds pretty brutally then. What happens once they actually reach Ku's residence?
Well, they open Ku's gate and just rush in shouting.
Chaos.
Total chaos. The family, understandably, is terrified. Old, young, male, female, they all try to hide. The mother goes under the bed, the old man behind the door.
Oh, wow.
And the sons, Ku Liang and Ku Dong, along with other relatives, they just flee in sheer terror.
And as the family scatters, the thieves get to work, I assume.
They do. They quickly light their torches and start looting. They open chests and basically search and seize everything.
Everything.
Gold, silver, treasures, jewelry, clothes, even household items. They are incredibly thorough. They leave nothing behind.
Sounds like just total devastation. And then the tragedy deepens for the Ku family, doesn't it? What happens to Ku Yuanwei himself?
It does. It gets worse. Ku Yuanwei, the patriarch, is apparently unable to part with his possessions. He comes out from hiding and actually pleads with the thieves, just asking them to leave some clothes for his burial.
Oh, that's heartbreaking.
And their response is just shockingly brutal. They kick him in the groin, leading to his instant death.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, the source gives this chilling, sort of classical Chinese description. Three souls returned to the underworld. Seven souls departed the mortal world.
Wow.
It really emphasizes a complete and final end.
A truly violent, senseless act. So once the deed is done, what happens to the thieves? Do they just vanish?
Pretty much. They flee the scene. They use these soft ladders to scale the city wall.
Soft ladders. Interesting detail.
Isn't it? And they disappear west into the rainy night, leaving behind this scene of just utter chaos and grief.
And the servants.
Ku servants emerge after the thieves are gone, find their master dead, and just cry out in despair, understandably.
Now, this is where the story takes that sharp, insidious turn, right? Moving from the external crime to something else. What happens inside the Ku household after the thieves have fled?
Yeah, this is the pivot. Around 4 a.m., the family's still reeling, obviously. The mother starts expressing this deep hatred for the Tang monk and his group.
Hatred? Why them?
Well, she blames them. She believes their grand, you know, flamboyant send-off earlier that day actually attracted the thieves.
Ah, misplaced blame.
Totally. Leading directly to this disaster. It seems like a classic case of misplaced blame, really, in the middle of terrible grief.
But it's more than just grief, isn't it? The source says she develops a jealous and harmful heart. What does she do with that resentment?
Well, what's truly fascinating, and frankly chilling, is how quickly she concocts this detailed, completely fabricated story.
Fabricated? How so?
She tells her sons, Ku Liang and Ku Dong, that she saw everything clearly from under the bed where she was hiding.
Okay.
And her tale is incredibly precise and damning. She gives each of the pilgrims a specific role in the crime.
Each one? Like what?
Exactly. She claims Tang Sang, the monk himself, lit the fire.
No.
Zhu Baji, Pigsy, held the knife.
Mm.
She He Shang, Sandy, carried the gold and silver.
Mm.
And Sun Wukong, Monkey.
Let me guess, he did the worst.
She claims Sun Wukong killed your father.
Wow. That's a complete inversion of reality, attributing the entire crime directly to their honored guests from just hours before.
It's astonishing. And the sons, Ku Liang and Ku Dong, they immediately believe her.
Just like that. How do they even begin to rationalize such a wild accusation against, well, monks?
Well, they rationalize it by saying, look, the monks had stayed for half a month. They became intimately familiar with the house's layout, the doors, walls, windows, alleys.
Okay, so opportunity.
And then they echo that common saying, wealth moves the heart, Kai Dong Ren Sin, implying a motive for the monks to return and steal.
Mm.
It's just astonishing how quickly a mother's emotionally charged, completely made-up story takes root with her sons, especially given, you know, the reverence monks usually got.
And the importance of respecting your parents' word, like filial piety.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That plays a huge role here. Her word carries immense weight, even when it's this outlandish.
It truly is remarkable. So based on this completely false testimony, the sons decide they're going to file a formal complaint.
In the morning, yeah, at the prefectural office.
Okay, so as the family is scrambling, arranging the funeral, Ku Liang and Ku Dong head straight to the prefectural office.
Mm-hmm.
And Ku Liang actually drafts the complaint based precisely on his mother's accusations. Tang Sing lit the fire, Baji ordered the killing, Sha Hishang carried out the gold and silver, Sun Wukong killed my father. Just lays it all out.
Word for word, based on her lie.
Who is the official they approach with these incredibly grave claims? Is he just some minor functionary?
No, and that's another interesting part. The official they approach is the prefect of Tong Taifu. And he's described as a righteous and virtuous official.
Righteous and virtuous.
Yeah, known for his integrity, benevolence, wisdom, even likened to these exemplary historical officials. So you'd expect someone like that to be discerning.
Right.
Meticulous.
You certainly would. That's the impression you'd get. So the prefect, after handling his other morning business, calls for the Ku brothers' complaint. Does he know anything about the monks beforehand?
He does. He actually notes the existing rumors, the local talk about Ku Yuanhui's grand hosting of the four esteemed monks from the Tang Dynasty and their big flamboyant send-off.
So he has some prior positive context about the monks.
He does. Yet. When the Ku brothers come in and repeat these false claims, emphasizing the monks' familiarity with the house, their supposed return under cover of night and storm, the theft, the murder, and they implore him for justice.
Mm.
His reaction is surprisingly swift.
Swift how? Does he launch an investigation? Question them further?
No. Without any further investigation, seemingly based solely on the Ku brothers' testimony.
Just their word.
Just their word, fueled by the mother's story. He immediately dispatches 150 swift riders and civilian guards.
150?
Yeah, 150 men armed with sharp weapons to pursue the Tang monk and his disciples west of the city gate.
Wow.
What's truly astonishing here is just the speed at which this false accusation gains traction and turns into an official armed pursuit.
It really is.
It really speaks to the immediate credibility given to the grieving family, doesn't it? Especially the mother, perhaps. And the trust placed in the word of those who seem distressed, even by a righteous official.
And just think about that sheer force, 150 armed men sent after four presumably unsuspecting pilgrims.
The huge response.
A powerful force deployed based on, well, seemingly very fragile evidence. This is where things get really interesting for our unsuspecting heroes, doesn't it?
Absolutely. The chase is on. It's dawn. The pilgrims Tang Monk, Sun Wukong, Pigsy, and Sandy, they're just leaving the Huaguan Monastery, heading west again.
Fresh start, you'd think. But, well, this is Journey to the West.
Huh? Yeah, never that simple. And they have no idea what's just up the road.
None at all. About 10 kilometers west, there's this gang. Over 30 bandits.
What are they doing?
They're in a mountain hollow dividing up loot. Gold, silver, clothes, the works. They robbed the Ku family, pulled it off the night before during a rainstorm.
Okay, so they're feeling pretty good about themselves, probably. Flush with cash.
Presumably, yeah. And then they spot the monks.
Oh, yeah.
And here's the twist. Some of the bandits actually recognize Tang Monk.
They recognize him. How? From the monastery.
Not just the monastery. From the send-off. Remember Ku Yuankai, the head of that family they just robbed?
Yeah.
He gave Tang Monk this huge, elaborate farewell party.
Yep.
Banners, drums, the whole thing. Very public.
Ah, okay. So the bandits saw that.
Some of them did, and they put two and two together. Big celebration from a rich guy.
Means the monk must be carrying something valuable.
Exactly. Pure greed kicks in. They decide, let's rob them too. So they block the road.
And demand.
Toll money. By road money, basically. Pay up or, well, The threat is pretty clear. Death.
Oof. Okay, so how do our pilgrims react? Tang Monk must be
terrified, absolutely terrified. Shaking on his horse, the text says.
Poor guy. And Pigsy, Sandy.
They're distraught. Pigsy's probably complaining, you know, after that awful rainy night, now this, that whole misfortunes never come singly thing.
Yeah, you can almost hear him. So total panic.
Almost. But not Wukong.
Ah, the great sage.
He's calm. Completely calm. Tells his master, tells his brothers, basically, don't worry, I got this. And he steps forward to talk to the bandits.
Okay, here we go. Does he just, like, unleash his powers?
Not yet. That's what's so interesting. He plays it smart. He goes up, acting all humble, like some simple village monk.
Really? Wukong? Humble?
He fakes it. It's brilliant, actually.
Yeah.
The bandits are demanding money, right?
Yeah.
So Wukong says, basically, oh, me. I'm just the accountant.
The accountant, seriously.
Yeah. He spins this whole story. Says, look, my master, he just chants scriptures all day, knows nothing about money or worldly things. Sandy, he just looks after the horse. And Plagsy, just a hired hand carrying the bags.
Uh-huh. Oh, wow. So he's downplaying everyone else.
Totally. Then he says, all the money we get from alms, I manage it. It's all in my bag. Tell you what, let my master and brothers go. Just let them pass, and you can have everything in my bag.
That's incredibly cunning. Not just brute force. He's playing them.
He really is. He figures they're just focused on the money, so he gives them a single, easy target himself, or rather his bag.
And do the bandits buy it?
Hook, line, and sinker. They think he's just some honest fellow and lost you too. They're like, okay, sounds good. They tell the others, drop your luggage and get going.
So Tang Monk and Pigsy just walk away.
Sandy drops the main luggage, and yeah, Tang Monk and Pigsy head west, probably thinking, phew, that was close.
But Wukong's still there. With 30 bandits waiting for his bag.
Exactly. And now the real plan starts. He pretends to fiddle with his bag like he's opening it.
Uh-huh.
Then suddenly he grabs some dust, sprinkles it, mutters a spell, the fixing body spell. Ding Shani Jaffa, and shouts, stop!
Whoa. Just like that.
Just like that. All 30 plus bandits, frozen solid, can't move, can't speak, instantly neutralized.
Okay, that's the Wukong we know. Magic time.
Right. So then he calls the others back. Master, brothers, come back.
What do they think? Pigsy must be confused.
And he's worried. He probably thinks Wukong somehow sold them out or something. But Sandy gets it.
Sandy knows Wukong's power.
Exactly. Sandy reassures Pigsy. Then Wukong tells them, okay, let's tie these guys up.
But they don't have ropes, do they? For 30 guys.
Nope. They mention that we don't have any ropes. So Wukong, classic Wukong move.
Plex some hairs.
He got it. Plex a few hairs. Breezes on them, poof, 30 ropes appear.
Always so resourceful. So they tie up the bandits.
Tie them up tight, the text says. Four limbs tied together like a pig for slaughter. Pretty vivid.
Yikes, okay. So the bandits are tied up, then he releases the spell.
Then he lifts the spell. They slowly come back to awareness, finding themselves completely helpless and bound.
Okay, so now what? Just leave them.
No, now it's interrogation time. Tang Monk sits down. The disciples stand guard with their weapons. You know, Pigsy's rake, Sandy's staff.
Setting the scene for some serious questions.
Right. They ask them, who are you? Where did you get this loot? Have you hurt anyone? They want the whole story. Turns out, it's actually kind of sad. They confess they're not, like, career bandits.
No. Then who are they?
They're basically sons of good families who blew their inheritances. Gambling, prostitutes, the usual downfall story.
Ah, so they're desperate. Not exactly evil mastermind.
Pretty much. They admit they robbed Ku Wong Kai the night before, and they were dividing that loot when they saw the monks.
And now they're begging for mercy.
Absolutely. Pleading. Offering to return all the stolen stuff.
How does Tang Monk take this? Especially hearing about Ku Wong Kai being robbed.
He's shocked and really distressed. He remembers Ku Wong Kai as a very good and kind old man. He can't believe this happened to him. He turns to Wukong, basically asking, why? Why him?
And Wukong has an answer.
He does, and it's quite insightful. He points out that Ku's incredibly lavish, very public send-off for them.
The drums and banners?
Yeah, that massive display of wealth and celebration. It basically put a spotlight on Ku's house for any rogues Gwangun, the text calls them, in the area.
So Ku's own generosity kind of backfired,
yeah.
Drew the wrong attention?
Inadvertently, yes. It's a subtle point about cause and effect. Even good deeds can have unexpected negative ripples.
Wow. That's quite a lesson. So what does Tang Monk decide to do now? He feels indebted to Ku, right?
Deeply indebted. He feels responsible in a way, so he proposes something. Let's return all this stolen stuff to Master Ku. It'll be a good deed.
A way to repay Ku's kindness. Does Wukong agree?
He does agree, which is maybe a little surprising given Wukong's pragmatism, but he goes along with it.
So they decide to return the loot. What about the bandits?
Well, first, Wukong, Pigsy, and Sandy go back to the hollow, gather up all the gold, silver, clothes, everything loaded onto the horse. Pigsy carries an extra bundle of gold and silver, too. Sandy picks up their own luggage again.
Okay, got the goods back. Now, what about the bandits? Does Wukong finish them off?
He thinks about it. The text says he considers killing them, probably to stop them from causing more trouble.
Makes sense from his perspective.
But he knows Tang Monk would absolutely hate that. Taking lives is a huge taboo for his master.
Right, so.
So Wukong restrains himself. He just collects his magic hairs, the ropes disappear, and the bandits are free.
And they just run away.
They leg it. Fast. Understandably.
Okay, so bandits gone, loot recovered.
Yeah.
Now the final step. Return it.
Exactly. Tang Monk, full of good intentions, decides they need to turn back and personally return everything to Ku Yongkai.
Going back the way they came.
Going back to do the right thing. But the chapter, this section of it, ends with this really striking poem.
Oh, what does it say?
It goes, "Do not take Wen Qin, Du Xin, Hu Shi Jin."
Can you translate that?
Roughly, it means, few people repay kindness with kindness. Instead, kindness often turns into enmity. Oh. Helping someone in danger can often lead to loss. Thinking thrice before you act prevents worries.
Whoa. That sounds ominous, like a warning.
These heroes,
they're literally on their way to return it all.
Pure compassion, pure gratitude.
And then, bam, out of nowhere, spears and knives. That's what they see coming at them, fast.
Instant trouble.
Pigsy, you know, ever the optimist, or maybe just hungry, thinks it's the bandits again. Back for round two.
All right, typical Pigsy.
But Sandy's like, no, wait, something's different. He senses it's not bandits and Monkey King. He's quiet, watching. He knows. He tells Sandy, it's Master's Calamity Star.
Ah, fate, predestined trouble.
Yeah, but specifically, he identifies them.
Yep.
Officers catching bandits. And just like that, they're completely surrounded.
And this is where you really see that perception shift, you know? One minute, they're benefactors returning stolen goods. The next, they're the criminals. It's such a stark example of judging by appearances, isn't it? Caught red-handed while doing the right thing. The irony is just incredible.
It really is. And the arrest is immediate. No questions asked, really. Soldiers grab Kang Sanzang first, pull him off his horse, tie him up, then they get the other three.
Swift, efficient, brutal.
Yeah. They're put on carrying poles, luggage gone, horse gone, march straight into the city.
Yeah.
And the way they react tells you so much. Tang Sanzang is trembling, speechless with tears, utterly devastated.
Understandably.
Pigsy. Muttering, resentful.
Yeah.
Probably complaining under his breath.
Definitely.
Sandy's described as baggy or bulky, kind of hesitant, maybe just confused by how fast it all happened.
Processing it all.
But Monkey King, he's just smiling, ready to show his skills. Mm. That contrast with his master's, wow.
It really stands out, doesn't it? It hints at his different perspective. And the prefect they're brought before, he doesn't hesitate either. He instantly rewards the locals for catching these supposed bandits.
Right. Gives the stolen goods back to the Ku family, congratulates everyone.
And then turns on the pilgrims. Calls them fake pilgrims, robbers.
Mm-hmm.
Says their holy appearance is just a disguise.
So Tang Sanzang tries to defend himself, naturally. He's desperate.
Of course. He insists we're real pilgrims from the great Tang Empire. Offers his official passport, the Tungwen Wendy, as proof.
Yep. Explains the whole story. They recover the goods from robbers. They were returning them. Seems straightforward.
It should be. That passport is serious business. It's got seals from kingdoms they've passed through. So the question is, why doesn't the prefect believe him? What's overriding that evidence?
Well, the prefect just waves it off, calls it clever lies. He even mocks him like, oh, really? You fought bandits. Why didn't you capture them and bring them in? Why didn't you show up with the loot?
Twisting the narrative.
And then he delivers the final blow. He says, Ku Liang accused you. Someone from the Ku family. Formally.
A direct accusation from the supposed victims, that changes things.
Completely. That plus the prefect's bias.
Yeah.
It's devastating for Tang Sanzang. The text says it's like a boat boiling in the ocean. His soul flew away and his spirit was lost. Total despair.
Wow. Broken.
He just cries out to Monkey King, debate, argue for us.
His last hope.
But Monkey King, his response is, Well, it's stunning. He just says there is stolen goods. What's the point of debating?
It sounds like a betrayal, like he's agreeing with the prefect.
Exactly. It's baffling on the surface.
But this is classic Monkey King, isn't it? There's always layers. He actually thinks his master sort of needs these trials. It's part of the journey, the karma.
Right, the purification process.
Exactly. Yeah. But he also doesn't want him to suffer needlessly or, you know, too much. So he steps in, but in his own very unconventional way. It's this mix of tough love, fierce loyalty, and understanding the bigger cosmic picture.
That makes sense. So as the court officials get ready to put this horrible torture device, a brain hoop, on Tang Sanzang,
meant to cause excruciating pain,
Monkey King steps forward, boldly, and declares, "Last night, I set the fire. I held the knife. I robbed the money. I killed. I'm the head bandit."
Takes it all on himself.
Yeah. He says, "Beat me if you want. It's got nothing to do with him. Just don't let me go."
Wow. What a move. It's pure strategy, isn't it? He's not guilty, obviously, but he takes a fall.
Oh.
It protects the master, buys them time, shifts the entire focus onto him. And maybe subconsciously, it starts showing just how extraordinary he is. Because what happens next with that brain hoop?
Right. The prefect, probably furious or maybe just intrigued, orders the hoop put on Monkey King instead. They try to tighten the ropes, put on his head, and the ropes just snap, ping, ping, 3-4 times.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't even leave a mark, not a wrinkle on his scalp. He's completely unfazed.
He's subtly revealing his power without, you know, transforming or fighting back directly. Defiance through invulnerability.
Exactly. And just as everyone's probably staring, wondering what on earth is going on, there's a commotion outside. News arrives. Grandfather Chen Xiaobao is here.
Yeah.
A higher-up official.
Our perfect timing.
The prefect has to drop everything and go meet him. Immediately.
Talk about a lucky break. Or maybe. Not just luck.
What do you mean?
Well, it saves them, right? Stops the immediate torture, prevents things escalating further right then. You could see it as fate intervening. Or perhaps it's a subtle ripple effect of Monkey King's own power, his destiny sort of, bending events around him to create an opening. Was it just coincidence? Or something more?
Interesting thought.
Huh.
Either way, it gives them a pause. But they're not free.
No, not at all.
They get shoved into the jail.
Uh-huh.
Secured onto these things called restraint beds. Such one.
Sounds nasty.
Yeah, tied up tight. Belly, head, chest, designed to be incredibly uncomfortable, painful even. And then the guards start beating them.
Standard procedure, unfortunately. Roughing up the prisoners.
Tang Sanzang is in agony, cries out, "Monkey King, what do we do?"
He turns to his problem solver.
And Monkey King's response is pure pragmatism. He says, basically, "Look, they're hitting us for money. It's a shakedown."
Ah, the old prison bribe.
He quotes a saying, something like, "Comfortable places need comfort, difficult places need money." Tells them, "Give them some cash, they'll stop."
Makes sense.
Yeah.
But
Tang Sanzang weighs, "Money! Where would I get money? He's a monk."
Right, he's renounced worldly goods.
So Monkey King says, "Okay, no money. Clothes will do. Give him the kasaya."
The kasaya? The sacred robe? Oh, wow.
Yeah, the priceless brocade kasaya, valued at 1,000 gold.
Tang Sanzang's reaction must have been intense. The text says it was like a knife in his heart.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. This isn't just a fancy robe. It's a symbol of everything. His mission, his faith, divine protection. It's spiritually invaluable.
Giving it up, that shows utter desperation. He must be truly at his wit's end.
For sure. And the guards, they hear kasaya, they hear value, and their greed just takes over.
Naturally.
They immediately start rummaging through the pilgrim's bundles. First, just normal monk clothes.
Mm.
Disappointment.
Uh-huh.
But then they find it, wrapped carefully in oiled paper. And it gives off this light, this radiant light.
Hmm.
Xiao Guanyanya.
It sounds incredible.
The description is amazing. Skillfully adorned with bright pearls, rare Buddhist treasures gathered. Coiled dragons paved in embroidery, flying phoenixes along the brocade edge. You can just picture it. This stunning, almost otherworldly garment.
A true treasure. Even the guards can see that.
All this excitement, the light, the guards probably arguing over it. It brings the head prison officer running.
Okay, the boss shows up. Sees the commotion.
The guards fess up. They show him the kasaya, basically ask him to decide who gets what, because they can't agree.
But this officer, thankfully, has a bit more sense. He doesn't just focus on the robe's value.
Right. He looks at the kasaya, yes. But then he looks at their other simple clothes. And then, this is key, he finds the travel pouch.
The pouch with the...
The passport. The Guanwen. He opens it. He sees the official seals. The signatures from all the different kingdoms they've passed through. Concrete proof.
Finally, objective evidence cuts through the noise.
And it clicks for him. He says, "Whoa, it's good I came. You idiots almost caused real trouble. These monks are not bandits."
He recognizes the legitimacy.
Tells them, "Don't touch their stuff. Wait for His Excellency," meaning the prefect, "to re-examine tomorrow. Then we'll sort this out."
And it's late, nearing dawn, actually, and Wukong notices they're all asleep, they're not groaning or anything, and he sees this as, like, a crucial sign that their prison disaster is nearing its fated end as the fourth watch approaches.
And that's more than just him noticing they're quiet, right?
Yeah.
It really highlights his remarkable strategic patience and his understanding of destiny, almost.
Yeah.
He knows their suffering is temporary, it's a fated hardship, basically. So he waits. He waits for the opportune moment. It shows real wisdom, not just, you know, jumping in, reacting.
Not impulsive at all.
No. He understands that any great plan needs perfect timing.
And when that timing is just right, Wukong kicks off his first intervention, playing the ghost of Ku Dagwan.
But not in the way you might expect.
Right. Instead of bursting in, making a big scene, he shrinks himself down into a tiny mongchonger, like a gnat, right?
Yeah, a tiny insect.
And this isn't just a magic trick. It's sort of Wukong's signature move for pure, undetectable recall.
Like stealth mode activated.
Totally. He stealthily flies out of the prison, just slips through a tile seam into the clear, quiet night. And this is where his strategic genius really starts to shine.
Okay.
He flies directly to the Ku family's gates. And that's where he overhears this completely unexpected but absolutely critical conversation.
Right place, right time. Or maybe he made it the right time.
Maybe. There's this brightly lit tofu maker's shop nearby, and he listens in. There's an old man and woman talking about Ku Dagwan.
The man they're accused of killing.
Exactly. And they reveal he was tragically kicked to death by robbers. Wukong quickly picks up these crucial details about Ku Dagwan's life from their chat. He was a former classmate of the old man, 5 years younger, apparently.
Personal connection there.
Yeah. And Ku Dagwan's father wasn't rich, but Ku Dagwan himself inherited the family fortune pretty young, at 20.
Okay.
His wife, Zheng Wang's daughter, they called her Chuanzerner, she was apparently Wang Fu, which means, like, she brought prosperity to her husband.
Right, good fortune. Helped him build his wealth.
Helped him amass 100,000 in assets, yeah. And then he turned philanthropic at 40, hosted like 10,000 monks. Yet he died at 64, a really sad end for someone who, you know, turned to good deeds. Wukong flies into the Ku family house. It's now the fifth watch, first point, so really early morning.
Getting close to dawn.
He finds the scene, the coffin, offerings, the mother, two sons, the daughters-in-law, all mourning. And his method is brilliant. He just lands directly on the coffin head and lets out a single cough.
Just a cough.
Just a cough. It terrifies the daughters-in-law, sends them scrambling. But the mother is brave. She asks if the old master is alive.
And Wukong?
Wukong, expertly impersonating Ku Dagwan's voice, just says, "I'm not alive." Chilling.
Wow. And what's fascinating here is the precise accusation Wukong, as this ghost, levels against the mother, Zhang Chuanzhenner.
Yeah.
He doesn't just say, "You lied." He uses these exact phrases.
Yeah.
H.C. carries, which means false accusations, slander, and framing the innocent.
Using their own concepts against them.
Exactly. He's attacking the root of the problem with their own terminology. It's a psychological blow, much more than just a simple threat.
And he spells out the specific false claims they pinned on the monks, like word for word almost.
What were they again?
Tang Monk lit the fire, Baji called for murder, Sha Monk robbed gold and silver, Wukong killed your father. It's so exact, leaves no wiggle room.
Yeah, and Wukong immediately hits them with a counter-narrative. Yeah. Makes it crystal clear. The Tang monks genuinely ran into robbers. They recovered the goods from robbers. They were returning them. He really stresses that good people are suffering all because of the mother's deceit. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this raises a point, doesn't it?
And then Wukong brings in the divine pressure. He tells them the prison gods, the local gods, even the city gods were all disturbed by this blatant injustice.
That's rippled upwards.
Big time. They reported it directly to Yama, the king of the underworld. And Yama personally dispatched Wukong.
So Wukong's acting on direct orders from the underworld judiciary, basically.
Pretty much. And he highlights the direct threat he's delivering now. If the monks aren't promptly released, he will disturb the house for a whole month.
A month of haunting. That's rough.
And ensures that us, not a single person, young or old, not even the chickens and dogs, will remain.
Whoa. Okay, that's not subtle.
No. It's a specific, terrifying ultimatum. Designed to force immediate action from this family, who are, you know, probably consumed by fear and guilt now.
And does it work?
Oh, it works. The Ku Liang brothers, the sons, they are utterly terrified. They immediately promise, okay, we'll submit a release request first thing in the morning. We'll admit we lied.
Huh. Fear is a great motivator.
It certainly is here. Wukong then just demands paper offerings, you know, for the ghost before flying off. Practical.
Even in spectral form.
But of course, his work isn't done. I mean, clearing his master isn't just about scaring one family, right? The system itself is part of the problem.
Yeah. The officials who imprison them need persuading, too.
Exactly. So who's his next target in this whole bureaucratic mess?
Let me guess. Someone higher up.
You got it. Wukong's second intervention targets the prefect, the Cixi.
Okay, the regional administrator.
He flies directly to the Cixi's residence, finds the prefect awake, interestingly enough.
Uh-huh.
Maybe worried.
Or just working late.
Could be. Wukong's method here is, again, super clever. He lands on a painting of an official.
On a painting.
Yeah. And he slyly identifies this painted figure as the Cixi's his great uncle's spirit. Then gives a little cough to startle the prefect.
Okay, so now he's impersonating an ancestor spirit. That's stepping it up.
Definitely.
And connecting this to the bigger picture, Wukong, as this revered ancestor, Ruyuti, directly confronts the prefect, calls him out for gross negligence.
What does he say?
Labels him ignorant for treating the four holy monks like common thieves and locking them up without even investigating properly.
Ouch. Calling the prefect ignorant to his face. Well, via his great uncle's spirit.
Exactly. It's a direct hit on the prefect's competence and integrity, and it's coming from a source he basically cannot ignore his own family lineage spiritual authority.
Powerful stuff.
And again, you see the consistency in Wukong's message. He reiterates, the prison gods, local gods, city gods, they were all disturbed. They reported it to Yama, who sent Wukong.
Same story, different audience.
But the consequence he mentions for the Cixi is way more chilling than just haunting a house.
Oh.
If he doesn't comply, he'll be summoned personally to the underworld for interrogation.
Directly accountable to Yama.
Wow. Yeah, it really demonstrates that seamless connection between the human and divine realms in this story. Consequences escalate based on your position, your responsibility.
The message is crystal clear then, coming straight from the spiritual hierarchy via a respected ancestor.
Undeniable, really.
So the terrified Cixi immediately promises, yes, I'll release them in court. And Wukong, ever the pragmatist.
Taper offerings.
Demands paper offerings again. But look, the pressure campaign isn't over. Wukong is leaving absolutely nothing to chance. He needs to make sure this message hits every level of authority involved.
He's being incredibly thorough.
Right. So as dawn breaks, Wukong approaches the Diling County officials, the local county guys, in court.
Okay. Down to the local level now.
And he knows he needs a tactical shift here. You know, whispering like a gnat or coughing like a subtle ghost, that won't cut it for a public display of power.
Need something bigger.
Oh, yeah. So he puts on this vivid, dramatic transformation from that tiny insect to a sock, a great Dharma body, a giant form just appearing in midair.
Ooh.
And he stretches down just one single foot that literally fills the entire county hall.
Fills the whole hall. Just 1 foot. Okay, that's intimidation.
That's making a statement.
And this is where the escalation really hits its peak, wouldn't you say?
Yeah.
He invokes an even higher divine authority now.
Ooh, this time.
He proclaims himself a wandering spirit sent by the Jade Emperor himself.
The Jade Emperor. Top of the celestial bureaucracy.
The absolute top. He announces that this unjust imprisonment of the Yur, the sutra-seeking Buddhist sons, has alarmed all the gods of the three realms.
So this isn't just Yama anymore. This is cosmic level concern.
Exactly. This is the supreme deity weighing in. A full-blown cosmic intervention.
And the threat he issues now must be immense.
Absolutely formidable. He says, if the monks aren't released immediately, you will return with another foot.
Oh, no.
And first, kick all you officials to death, then stomp all the residents of the whole area to death and reduce the entire city to ashes.
Wow. Okay. Let's talk about an incentive. He's leaving zero room for negotiation or delay.
None whatsoever. This final, just overwhelming display of power ensures absolute, unquestioning compliance. There's no arguing with that kind of direct, cataclysmic threat from the highest divine authority.
No kidding.
It really underscores that sometimes, you know, profound injustice, especially when it affects people on a sacred mission like this, it requires an equally profound, maybe even terrifying intervention to make things right. It's like the ultimate check and balance in this cosmic system.
So the resolution to all this, all these meticulously planned interventions by Wukong.
What happens after the giant foot threat?
After securing all these promises from the grieving family, the prefect, the county official's Wukong just calmly retracts his giant form.
Back to normal.
Back to a tiny Meng Chonger, the little gnat again, flies back into the prison, quietly gets back into bed, and resumes his sleep as if absolutely nothing happened.
Ah.
The very next morning, those same Kuliang brothers, they're back at the prefect's court.
To add more accusations.
Nope. To take it all back. Retract everything.
What? Why the sudden change of heart?
Well, get this. Their father, Ku Hong, the one who died during the robbery, he appeared to them.
Appeared? Like a ghost?
Exactly. The text calls it a hot corpse new ghost.
Ah.
Which sounds pretty intense.
Yeah, it definitely paints a picture.
And Ku Hong sets them straight, tells them, look, that Tang Dynasty holy monk, totally innocent, explained how he, Tang Sanzang, actually caught the robbers, got the stuff back, returned it, pure goodwill.
So the ghost of the victim is the key witness.
It's the first major signal that, you know, good deeds don't go unnoticed. There's some kind of cosmic accounting going on.
That's fascinating. So it's not just...
Ku Hong explains that the local earth gods, the city gods, they saw this injustice happen and were so disturbed.
They couldn't let it stand.
Right. They reported it straight up the chain all the way to Yama, the head honcho of the underworld.
Okay. In Yama.
Yama doesn't mess around, dispatches a ghost envoy right away, tells the sons, fix this, make it right, or your whole family's in big trouble.
Serious stuff.
And it doesn't stop there. The prefect, the guy who jailed them, he gets a message too.
From who? Another ghost.
Yeah. His own dead uncle, apparently dead for 5 or 6 years, shows up in a vision. Same message. Monks are innocent. Let them go. Now.
Okay, so multiple ghostly interventions. The pressure's mounting. Does the prefect listen?
He's definitely thinking about it, pondering these, you know, spectral pleas. But then things escalate big time.
No.
Local officials burst into the court. They've got news. Urgent news.
From where? Even higher up?
All the way to the top. The Jade Emperor himself, the supreme Taoist deity, he sent a special messenger, a roaming deity, down to Earth.
Wow. The Jade Emperor. What's the message?
It's not a request. It's an ultimatum. Release the monks immediately. They are not robbers. They are, and I quote, Buddha's disciples on a scripture-seeking journey.
Okay, that's clear enough.
And the consequences for not complying.
Let me guess.
Pretty bad.
You could say that. The officials would be kicked to death, the entire city, trampled to ashes, everyone in it.
Whoa! Okay, that's persuasive.
Yeah. The prefect apparently goes pale, experiences great astonishment and loss of color. I mean, what choice does he have? None. He has to comply immediately.
Exactly. So prison doors fly open. Monks are brought back to the court.
And this is where Monkey King steps up, right?
Oh, yeah. This is his moment. He tells his master, Tang Sanzang, don't kneel. Trust me, they'll be begging us to sit soon. I've got this handled.
He sounds pretty confident.
He knows the divine cavalry has arrived, basically. He's not just a disciple now. He's like the enforcer of this heavenly judgment.
So what does he do? Just demand their stuff back?
Aggressively demands it. He points fingers. Where's our white horse? The people in the hall took it. Where's our luggage? The prison guards got it.
He's not holding back.
Not at all. He threatens to personally interrogate them if anything's missing. Accuses them point blank. You wrongfully took innocent people for thieves.
And the officials, I bet they're terrified now.
Absolutely scrambling. They just heard the Jade Emperor's threat, remember? So they brush off, find everything, bring it all back super fast.
Do they apologize?
They kind of try to blame the Ku family, using them as a scapegoat for their own rush to judgment. You know, oh, the Ku family made the mistake.
Typical. But Tang Sanzang, the master, he's usually more measured, isn't he?
Always. Even with Monkey King basically flexing his divine connections, Tang Sanzang suggests something else. He says, let's go to the Ku family's house.
Why? To rub it in?
No. To offer condolences for Ku Hong's death. And to, you know, clarify the situation directly, he senses there's still more to uncover, a deeper truth maybe.
Right, because they still don't technically know who killed Ku Hong. The ghost just said the monks were innocent.
Precisely. And this leads to Monkey King's next, maybe even more incredible, move.
What does he do now?
At the Ku house, surrounded by the grieving family and the officials, Monkey King just casually announces, don't worry, I'll just call the dead person back to life.
He says what?
Yeah. I'll bring him back so he can tell us himself who killed him. The officials are just stunned. They think he's gotta be joking.
I mean, who wouldn't?
But Monkey King, he's dead serious. He leaps straight up into the sky. Poof, gone.
Just like that.
Leaving behind this trail of colorful clouds and auspicious energy, everyone down below is just staring, mouths open. They realize, okay, this guy isn't just a disciple. He's an immortal who rides clouds, a saint who raises the dead.
Wow, so where does he go? Straight to the underworld.
Yep. The text says he reaches the Hifuizhi, the underworld, almost instantly, walks right into the main hall, the Hesuite, where Yama hangs out. The 10 kings of Yama, all the ghost judges, they all bow respectfully when he enters, greet him properly. His very presence changes the place. The source says sword trees flatten, knife mountains become smooth, evil spirits in the city of the wrong transform, ghosts start crossing the bridge to get reborn. It's like his arrival brings this divine light, a kind of heavenly pardon.
That's incredible. His aura alone cleanses the place. So he gets there, asks the kings, where's Ku Hong's ghost?
Right, and here's another twist. They tell him Ku Hong isn't just some random soul they grabbed. He's a good person.
Okay, so.
So he wasn't dragged there by some ghost envoy. He actually came to the underworld on his own accord after dying. And because he was known for hosting monks, showing hospitality.
Like he did for Tang San Zeng and the crew just before all this happened.
Exactly. Because of that good deed, he was taken directly to see Ketigarbha Bodhisattva.
Ketigarbha. The one known for saving souls from hell.
That's the one. A major bodhisattva. A golden-robed child brings Ku Hong before him. And Ketigarbha explains, look, your natural lifespan was up. It was your time.
Ah, so it wasn't the robbers directly ending his fated life, just the mechanism.
Seems like it. His time was up. But Audio, because of his great merit, specifically hosting the monks, Ketigarbha didn't just let him move on. He appointed Ku Hong to a position right there in the underworld.
A job. In the afterlife.
Yeah. As a record keeper of good deeds, his good actions earned him a place of honor.
Wow. So hosting monks really pays off in this universe.
Big time. But Monkey King isn't there for Ku Hong to start his new job. He's there to bring him back.
Right. Does Ketigarbha agree?
Monkey King asks, and Ketigarbha says yes. Not only does he agree to release him, but he grants him an extension on life.
An extension? How long?
One Jian, the text says, which is 12 years, adds a whole dozen years to Ku Hong's lifespan because of Monkey's request and implicitly because of Ku Hong's own merit.
12 extra years of life, just like that. That's incredible. Good karma, literally rewriting the books of fate.
It's a huge statement in the story. Ku Hong, naturally, is overwhelmed with gratitude. Thanks, Monkey King. Thanks, Ketigarbha, profusely.
Okay, so Ku Hong's soul is released. How does Monkey King get him back into his body?
It's pretty dramatic. Monkey King flies back to the Ku family home, takes Ku Hong's spirit, described as being blown into a wisp of air, and then just pushes it back into the body lying there in the coffin.
And does it work?
Instantly. Ku Hong sits up, climbs right out of the coffin. Everyone's stunned. He immediately falls to the ground, prostrating himself before Tang San Zhang and the others. Calls it a recreation of life.
I bet. So now he can finally tell everyone what really happened.
Exactly. He speaks directly to the officials. It was robbers, he says. 30 plus of them, flames, weapons, they looted the place. And then the crucial part. One of them kicked me. Kicked me to death in the groin. Clears the monks completely. Absolutely innocent.
Wow. Talk about definitive proof. What about his sons who accused the monks?
Oh, he confronts them. Who? Who dared make such a false accusation against these holy men? They immediately kneel down, apologizing for their mistake.
And the prefect. He must feel pretty foolish now.
You'd think so, seeing the literal dead man stand up and testify.
Yeah.
He grants the Ku family leniency, finally understanding the massive injustice he almost presided over.
So everything's resolved. Justice served, thanks to ghosts, gods, and Monkey King's trip downstairs.
Pretty much. Ku Hong, being alive again and super grateful, throws a big feast to thank everyone, especially the officials, ironically enough, tries to get Tang San Zhang to stay longer.
But Tang San Zhang is a mission to complete, right?
Always focused. He gently refuses. Time to get back on the raid to get those scriptures.
So they leave. How's the send-off this time?
Magnificent. Way bigger and grander than even the welcome they first got. The Ku family, the officials, everyone turns out. It's a huge procession full of respect and awe now.
A complete turnaround. It really drives home that final message, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The one from the source material.
It absolutely does. That line. Where the earth opens, evil deeds may exist, but high heaven does not betray good-hearted people.